Good morning. You may be seated. First case on our calendar is 09-886, State of Ohio, City of Oregon versus James Downauer. Mr. Nathan.
May it please the court. My name is Dan Nathan, and I represent the appellant James Downauer in this case. Your Honors, this is a case of undisputed facts and a single legal issue to be presented to the court, and that is whether a defendant is entitled to a new trial where, over his objection, an alternate is instructed to be present with the jury during deliberations. At James Downauer's trial, the trial judge did give such an instruction, and the alternate was present during the jury deliberations for the entire course of those deliberations, including when the final vote of the jury was taken. And that all took place over the timely objection of Mr. Downauer's counsel. The judge's instruction was in violation of RC 2313.37C, which requires that the alternate, quote, shall be discharged upon the final submission of the case to the jury. Quote. The issue here is what remedy, if any, is appropriate. The issue has been before this court previously in 2002 in State versus Gross, and the holding in Gross calls for Mr. Downauer to be granted a new trial. In Gross, this court held that where there is a timely objection, the burden will be on the state to show a lack of prejudice where an alternate is allowed to be present with the jury. In this case, the state did not meet that burden.
What was the prejudice that inured to your client as a result of the alternate being present in the deliberating room under the court's instruction that the alternate not participate at all during the deliberative process?
I think the answer to that is that we don't know what the prejudice was, and we can't know what the prejudice was. And I think this court wisely put the burden on the state to show a lack of prejudice. So if the burden is on my client to show prejudice, I don't think I can prevail today because I can't show it. We don't know what happened in that jury room. As far as the court's instructions, of course, it is always presumed that jurors follow a trial court's instructions. I think the instructions in this case were particularly vague, and I will read you. There was one sentence in the trial court's instructions about what the alternate should do in that jury room. And the sentence was, as you will retire to the jury room with 8 members of the jury and the alternate for deliberation, the alternate is not to participate in the deliberation process. There is no detail given about you're not to speak, you're not to indicate by gestures or in any other way what your position is. Just, you're not to participate in the deliberation process. I would argue that even in Gross, where we know that there was some inappropriate behavior by the alternate jurors, even there, a strong argument could be made that there was no participation in the deliberation process.
Counsel, I'm looking at the Court of Appeals opinion here, and it says, it says in the present case, we're required to find that pursuant to Gross, the municipal court committed error in allowing the alternate juror to be present. Then it says, nonetheless, contrary to the situation in Gross, there's not one scintilla of evidence in the record showing that the juror actively participated. Moreover, the trial court gave the appropriate instructions in this situation. What on earth is an appropriate instruction if Gross says the alternate juror is not to be there in interpreting the rule? What do they mean by appropriate instruction?
I think that there is a strangeness to that it's okay for the trial judge to violate the law as long as he instructs the alternate jurors properly. Usually we have a curative instruction where a witness says something that is inadmissible, that is not of the judge's own doing. So in this case, the trial judge created the problem, then gave an instruction, which I believe I don't think this case rises or falls on the content of the instruction, but I do believe that that instruction was wholly inadequate. I mean, in Gross, we had jurors.
Well, if we have said the rules require the alternate not to be in the room during deliberations, how can you possibly give an instruction that cures your violation of that determination?
I absolutely agree with you. I don't think any instruction, no matter how thorough, no matter how good, I don't think any instruction would cure that error. First of all, because the statute is mandatory, and this court has said you can't send the juror in, and if the juror goes in over the defendant's objection, the state is going to have to prove that there was no prejudice. Now, you know, a big part of the problem is that that's not something that in most cases the state will be in a position to prove.
Okay. I'm assuming your client had a lot of evidence against him in this case, in the underlying case.
You know, I was not involved at the trial level. There was enough evidence that a jury convicted him. Obviously, he would hope for a...
This wasn't some circumstantial case, I'm assuming. There was a breathalyzer and all of that.
I believe there was a breathalyzer, and I was not involved at the trial level. I don't know how overwhelming the evidence was, and we are not asking for an acquittal today. We are asking for a new trial. If the evidence was overwhelming against him in the first trial, he will be convicted again. But he, nonetheless, no matter how strong the evidence was, he's entitled to a fair trial. And following the law in Gross, I believe he's entitled to that new trial.
Well, counsel, if we let this stand, the way the Court of Appeals has analyzed it, the burden is to show an active participation which would be placed on the defendant in order to trigger the presumption of prejudice. Is that correct? Well, in other words, the defendant isn't entitled to the presumption of prejudice because of the error of the extra juror, the alternate juror, unless he or she shows that the juror participated.
I believe that that is the way the Sixth District wrote it. That's correct. I don't believe that that's the way this court held in Gross. And the problem that I have with that is, how can the defendant prove that there was participation, first of all? Secondly, the word participation is not descriptive enough. I don't know exactly what that means. Did the alternates in Gross participate? They played cards, which I don't think is participating in deliberations. They threw pens, which I don't think is participating in deliberations. One of the alternates in Gross indicated that he believed that some of the jurors were regular jurors were being pressured by other regular jurors.
In fact, we're not really even. Your position is it doesn't. The presence is sufficient to trigger the prejudice, the presence of the alternate, participation or not. If he just sat there in the corner, it still was a trigger for the prejudice, and then the state has not shown that the prejudice was, that there was something to counterweight the prejudice, the presumed prejudice.
That's correct. And that's what the court said in Gross, that it is the presence of the juror in the room that triggers the shifting of the burden to the state, the presence. And that word is specifically used in Gross.
Was there ever a request, either by the state or by the defense counsel, for a voir dire examination of jurors in this case?
There was no request by either party for a voir dire of jurors. Because the burden was on the state, it would have been that's a problem for the state, I believe, that neither side requested.
And after the objection was raised, did the court conduct any proceeding of any type with respect to voir dire of what had occurred during the deliberation?
No, Your Honor, I believe not. Either sua sponte or by the request of either party, the court did not question the jurors regarding what went on in the jury room.
So we can't tell from the record, I guess, why the trial judge committed what appears to be error.
We can only guess. We can, you know, I mean, the reason to do this, I think, is for efficiency's sake, in case something happens to a regular juror, you've got the alternate there, you don't have to start over. And we can only guess whether the trial judge didn't know that what he was doing was improper, or knew, but thought it wouldn't matter. And unfortunately, if the Sixth District decision is upheld by this court, then I believe the trial judge and all trial judges will be told that you really can do what you want. Because just as the state really was not in a position to show what happened in that jury room, neither was the defendant. And the earlier question about did anybody ask for a voir dire, of course, I argue in my brief that if anybody had asked for that, that request would have properly been denied, because it is not proper to inquire into the mental processes of the jurors.
Well, counsel, it wouldn't necessarily be the mental processes. The question, not substantively what the juror said or how the juror voted or the level of participation, just did the juror speak or did the juror signal or did the juror write, you know, not the content. And that would be sufficient to show participation.
That certainly could be helpful to give some idea of what happened in the jury room. I think, as I argued in my brief, I think that it is probably unrealistic for us to imagine that jurors are going to be able to give an accurate account of whether they were influenced by anything that the alternate juror did.
But let me ask you, if they did ask that question, if the court did not get to the substance, but merely what the juror did, and it was disclosed that the juror did nothing but sit in the corner mute, no gestures, where would you be at that point?
Well, I think that would be a much closer case if we had that on the record, that the juror sat mute without gesturing.
So you would uphold the standard that says that if the state proves that there was no participation, even though there was presence, then they rebut the presumption of prejudice. Is that true?
Your Honor, I think that that's not how I would do it. I mean, I think that the best way to handle this situation is to say, if the alternate is in there for the entire course of deliberations, there's prejudice. End of story. And, you know, this is the kind of error that should not happen with any frequency at all. I mean, this court, the district courts should not see this kind of case. It's not a judgment call for the trial judge.
Is this a rarity or is this a common occurrence in
your
experience?
As far as cases being appealed on this issue, I believe it's a rarity. Since Gross, I believe there have only been two cases, this one and the second district case.
I understand
case
the reported cases, but what I'm asking you is, what is the practice throughout maybe the Sixth District or the breadth of your experience?
And I don't know the answer to that question because I don't do trial work, but I suspect that Mr. Dugan probably could give you an answer to that better than I could.
What more could we write than what we've written in Gross in this case to tell trial judges that they should not permit alternates to go into the deliberating room? My goodness, we have a rule. We have a court decision. I mean, what is it that we can do here that we haven't already done?
Well, that's a great question, because I think that Gross does control this case.
It's a great question.
I think that to the extent that there has been confusion in the districts over Gross, it is because of the difficulty in either side meeting a burden to show prejudice or lack of prejudice. So I think that what this court could do beyond what it has done in Gross is to clarify, as courts have done in some other states, that yes, we're putting the burden on the state, and if you send the alternate in over the objection of the defendant and the alternate is there the whole time, you're not going to be able to rebut the presumption. That's the end of the story. There are other situations where a presumption maybe could be rebutted.
Can you think of any circumstance in which an alternate should be in the deliberating room?
I don't think there's any circumstance.
Why do you qualify it by saying over objection and for the entire time?
Well, and certainly, there, amicus brief argued that this is structural error, and even if there is no objection, there should be a new trial. I'm fine with that. That, you know, my client prevails if that's how this court decides. I don't need the court to go that far. I mean, as I'm looking at all of the states, states have taken different positions on what to do where there's no objection. Is there still a presumption? Is there still an irrebuttable presumption? The only problem I see, if this court says new trial no matter what, even with no objection, the problem is that then it is in the interest of the defense counsel to allow that error to occur, because then he gets two bites at the apple. Maybe his client will be acquitted. If not, the alternate's in there, he'll get another chance. That's really the only drawback to what you're suggesting, but I think there are some good reasons for that as well. And I see that my time is up.
So thank you, Mr. Nathan.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Dugan. Mr. Dugan, before I even begin, let me say to you that this appears to me, at least to me, and you can argue against it if you'd like, certainly, but this appears to me to be another one of those cases in which we're presented with an issue where the trial judge has committed error, and then now appellate courts, us, we're asked to sort of fix it. The error here is clear, the rule is clear, and it seems to me all of the questions that came to Mr. Nathan are exactly the types of questions that we shouldn't be asking, because the alternate juror shouldn't be in the jury room. What's your response? Breathless, speechless.
Thank you, Your Honor. It may please the court, I guess.
Mind on the issue, by the way. So.
Thank you. My response to that, Your Honor, is that as much as there is a rule, obviously, that says that the alternate jurors are supposed to be dismissed at time of the deliberation process, it has happened before, either accidental or on purpose, where the alternate has gone into the courtroom or the deliberation room. I would respond to Your Honor's question in that we need to look at the error and evaluate it under the harmless error standard, as this court has decided in Gross, when there is a timely objection. If there was, I know Mr. Nathan kept going on about over objection. This court has stated before, if there is no objection, we need to look at the plain error standard. But that's obviously not the case in this case.
I guess the problem with the objection route is that it's the trial judge's responsibility to follow the rules. And here the trial judge didn't follow the rules. Then we say, well, there's a difference whether or not one of the parties objected. Well, why?
Your Honor, I may actually be able to shed some light on that. The reason, and this is all offhand, off-the-record knowledge, but from what I understand, the reason the judge in this case put the alternate juror into the jury room during the deliberations is because he was under the mistaken impression that that was the way the rule was going to be changed for some odd reason. Since this incident, we have had multiple other jury trials in the Oregon Municipal Court, and the judge has dismissed the alternate juror outright. So this is not a reoccurring issue. The judge understands he made a mistake. It is our position that that mistake did not prejudice the defendant and does not require a new
trial.
Even
without a showing that, and you agree, the state did not meet a burden to show non-participation or any to rebut the presumption of prejudice.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. I believe the state has, in fact, met the burden by using the presumption of regularity that all trial proceedings have. And Mr. Nathan indicated that he didn't put too much stock into the instruction that the trial judge gave the jury. I, on the other hand, believe that the instruction is actually very well dispositive in this case. The instruction to me is unambiguous and very clear that the alternate juror was not to participate in any manner with the deliberative process.
But that is an erroneous instruction to begin with, because you shouldn't have to make that instruction. So the presumption of regularity is thwarted at the get-go when the judge is speaking those words.
Your Honor, the irony of what I'm arguing is not lost on me, but it is, in fact, what I am arguing.
But you're going to argue that jury instruction is sufficient. We're going to presume the regularity, even though we know on its face the judge is not acting with regularity, and that presumption of regularity is going to rebut the presumed prejudice that attaches to the presence of the juror in the jury room. Is that what you're saying?
In a nutshell, yes, Your Honor. That is exactly what I'm saying. I'm arguing that the jury members are presumed to follow the instructions given to them by the judge. The judge indicated to the jury, to the alternate juror, that one, he was not to participate, and number two, if the incident occurred where one of the actual juror, sworn jury members fell ill and could not complete the deliberative process, that he was to step in, that he would be stepped in to the seat of that juror, and that that deliberations would begin from the beginning, from the start all over again. I would argue to this court that, yes, the jury instructions given to the alternate juror does show that the court was mindful that he's not supposed to participate. Again, the reason he put him in there was, I'm not entirely sure. I believe on the record his reasoning was that if one of the jury members did in fact fall ill, again, in municipal court we only have eight.
Empirical data that indicates how many jurors have to be removed from the jury deliberation room for illness or for some extreme reason? Is this something that's been happening in that courtroom?
No, Your Honor. As far as I know, there's never once been a juror that's had to be excused during the deliberative process. In fact, if Your Honors want a direct answer to that, my father at counsel table is the Oregon City Prosecutor. I could ask him really quick if you'd like an answer to that.
Counsel, were you the trial counsel?
Oh, no, Your Honor. I'm not a prosecutor in the Oregon Municipal Court. I'm just independently hired to. But Mr. Dugan at the table was, in fact, trial counsel. I was at the trial. I witnessed the whole
trial.
Okay,
and these things are usually one-day trials.
It was, Your Honor.
It was a one-day trial. So what I'm having a hard time understanding, you've read Gross.
Yes.
Gross is pretty clear-cut, and add to that Justice Douglas's dissent, which the chief joined, and I wrote on this subject as well. Why on earth, when you're handed this, don't you just say, do another one-day trial? You made a mistake, and instead you go to the Court of Appeals, and they come up with this opinion that seems to say, well, the judge did it wrong, but he gave a curative instruction. You can't cure doing something that's wrong. So now we're here. So now you've taken up the resources of the Court of Appeals and our resources to do something that could be cured by just doing a do-over in a one-day trial. That's what I really can't comprehend.
Well, Your Honor, unfortunately, that is not my call. I was hired specifically to do all appellate work on this case, so.
Well, but lawyers are paid to give judgments. You look at this and you read Gross. Why isn't your advice to your client, do it over?
To be honest, Your Honor, I believe that the error was harmless and that we don't need to do a do-over. And to be honest, I couldn't ever pass up the opportunity to appear before this court and argue. Either.
Oh, that's.
So when there's a rule when there's a Supreme Court rule that says trial judge, you do X, it's okay for the trial judge to what you're saying. It seems to me you've been given a square baseball here to hit out of the park. I understand you. The record's not very easy to argue, but it seems that what you're saying is where the rule is clear. It's okay for the trial judge to make an error, and then you look at, well, was anybody prejudiced by it? Well, we look at prejudice in, as you know, many, many instances, but those are usually judgment calls, not where the trial judge just clearly violates the rule. The judge here violates the rule, and then he tells the alternate juror, don't you violate my instruction. If there's any inconsistency in that?
You know, again, I do understand the irony of your question. The response I would have to that, honestly, is that, yes, the trial judge did make a mistake, and obviously it is error. Again, it is our position that that the error was harmless, but it's hard to conceive that, you know, in one instance, the trial judge is making an error in judgment and in law, and in the other hand, telling the alternate juror that, you know, I'm making a mistake, but, and again, actually, he's not telling the alternate juror because the jurors don't know he's making a mistake.
Mr. Dugan, let me ask you a different route on this. If this court is of a mind that the rule means no alternates in the deliberating room during the deliberation process, and if Gross reinforces that rule, and we want to make that point so that we avoid what you're suggesting to us, as I'm thinking, your argument is this was error, but it was harmless error. How could we make the point more strongly than we've already done with a rule and with what we've written in Gross? What else should we tell courts and lawyers so that we can drive the point home?
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that this court has made very clear that this is error that is not to be expected. Again, a lot of judges don't want to be called what they're doing a mistake. At least that's my presumption. From what I understand, as much as Mr. Nathan said so, I don't believe this is an occurrence that happens all too often. Mistakes are going to happen. Yes, I'm fairly certain, and as I said, this mistake has not been repeated in the Oregon Municipal Court. When there's been another jury trials after this event, I don't believe that this court needs to be very worried that this is happening throughout the districts. Again, there may be cases that go unappealed, but as far as I know, Your Honor, this is the only occurrence in the Oregon Municipal Court's history where this.
Would another answer be? I'm sorry to interrupt. Would another answer be that if we reverse this case on these facts, where there's no showing of activity by the alternate juror, that is the next piece of Gross, and then maybe trial judges will understand that the rule means what it says? Wouldn't that be an answer?
It could, Your Honor. I would say that the only further this court could go is to make the error per se error, a structural error, and just basically change its mind from what you said in Gross.
That was going to be my question. Doesn't Gross give us... Gross kind of creates the problem you face because Gross says it's error, but then Gross gives an out.
I would say yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
And so if we really don't want, and if we want to presume a per se prejudice, we need to modify Gross, because Gross allows the error to occur with a correction because it gives an out. Is that the problem?
Your Honor, I would actually agree with that. The entire reason we are here now is because we are arguing what this court said in Gross. If this court is of the mindset that the error is still not structural, then we have to get into this debate of whether or not the error was harmless or not. And again, it is our position that the defendant was not prejudiced at all by the presence of the alternate juror in the jury room, or that even if...
Because Gross does not go so far as to call it structural. Gross allows a harmless error analysis with a showing of prejudice.
Correct, Your Honors. In fact, this court has had three opportunities to call this very error structural in Murphy, in Jackson, and in Gross, in all three times. Now, those first two cases, there was no objection, so the court used the plain error standard to analyze that issue. However, this court could have called that error structural three times, and it has not.
And Mr. Dugan, you keep referring to the municipal court. This has bigger implications for all trials, and the question is, what do we do when there's an alternate put into the deliberation room? So, as Justice Stratton points out, right now we deal with Gross, which puts the burden on the state to show that there was, in fact, prejudice, or that the trial court did not cure the error. Is your position that the jury instructions here did cure the error?
It is, Your Honor. My argument is not only that the instructions did cure the error. On the other hand, Your Honors, I would actually also argue that if this court is worried about, you know, what happened in that jury room, I would agree with what the justice had said earlier to Mr. Nathan, is that the error actually could still be cured to this moment. We have not asked any of these jurors what happened in that jury room. I understand the trial did happen at the end of 2007, and then it is now 2010. However, we have not asked. And it simply could come down to the fact that we could get either any of these, all of these jury members back into a courtroom for a hearing, or to submit affidavits to the court. And if this court would remand to the trial court for a hearing on the issue, you know, that we could attempt to cure the error in that way, because I believe that simply asking the juries whether or not the jury instructions were followed by all the jury members, including the alternate, does not delve into the mindset of a juror about the validity of their verdict.
Or only the error could be cured by a new trial.
Oh, obviously, yes, Your Honor. Any error can always be cured by a new trial. I can't deny
Counsel,
that.
Counsel, how long did it take the jury to deliberate here?
Your Honor, I was not long. I want to say it was an hour and a half,
okay.
Maybe at most 2 hours. It was not a very long time, but it was a trial on an OVI.
Yeah, I understand that.
It was the issue, as the court asked Mr. Nathan, there was evidence, a lot of evidence on the record. There was a refusal on the breathalyzer exam, though. But there was enough evidence for a jury to convict. There was testimony given by both sides. So yes, Your Honor, there was the trial. Other than this, went very smoothly and very cleanly. This is obviously the big issue. And
one possible way to preserve Gross without overruling it is to find that there was error. The state then had the burden of showing it, and a presumption of regularity is not sufficient to establish the burden. State failed to meet the burden, therefore a new trial.
Again, if that's what Your Honors believe, then yes, that would be what Your Honors could do for Gross. Again, I would argue that the state, in fact, has met the burden with the presumption of regularity.
But the problem with the presumption of regularity is it's really no showing at all. It throws the burden really back to the defendant to rebut, because you can presume presumption everywhere, or presume regularity everywhere.
That's possible, Your Honor.
Counsel, how far do you, in your view, could an inquiry go of the jurors with respect to conduct by the alternate juror? You think under our rules that could be explored?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. Having looked at the evidentiary rule for and allowing jurors or denying the jurors the ability to testify as to the validity of their verdict, I don't believe that asking them if they if the alternate juror had actually participated in the jury deliberations or not goes to the mindset of the jury. I believe that goes to whether or not the jury followed the instructions or the laws given to them by the judge, which again is not the law, which is again kind of an odd juxtaposition or oxymoron, I guess. Your Honor, I see my time is up.
Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Nathan, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Mr. Dugan, do we have to modify Gross in any way? I'm sorry, Mr. Mason.
Oh.
Excuse me. Mr. Mason, do we have to modify Gross?
Gross does not need to be modified in order for my client to prevail. Just on the facts of Gross, the burden was not met, as Justice Stratton stated. It seems to me that it would be prudent to clarify Gross so that courts are not confused by the issue of the presumption in a situation where the presumption almost certainly cannot be met. I also just want to point out that this court and many state Supreme Courts have explained that influence can occur by gestures, facial expressions, even the mere presence of the juror in the room. This court held that in Gross, can influence the regular jurors. So it is really not practical to question the jurors regarding whether they were influenced, especially 3 years after the fact. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nathan. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.